So, well, this is a paper about it is an attempt to substantiate, in a way, the current rediscovery of Keynes' thinking about international issues. And the paper is entitled Indian Currency and Beyond, and clearly refers to Indian Currency and Finance, and the first masterpiece by Keynes in 1913. And the subtitle is The Legacy of the Early Economics of Keynes in the Times of the Bretton Woods II System, which is in current times. This is, in a way, the outline of this paper. We try to focus on Keynes's fresh look at Asia in 1914 to see if the rediscovery of this masterpiece by Keynes could be helpful for a criticism of a current Bretton Woods II agreement or tacit agreement informing the current global architecture. So that through the rediscovery of what we call the Bretton Woods Zero system outlined by Keynes in Indian Currency and Finance, and the rediscovery also of the continuity between this work and Keynes's final plans for the reform of the global architecture, we try to see if this kind of rediscovery can be helpful for a reform of the global architecture in current times. So, in a sense, the paper outlines three kinds of disseminations of economic ideas, that is, from Asia to Europe, then in Indian Currency and Finance, and from the periphery, this is the parallel, to the core of the system in current times. But also, this parallel between the 1914 vision by Keynes of international setting and his later reflections on the reform of the global architecture in the 40s, and finally from Keynes to our times and possible to the future, in the sense of a reform of the current system. Now, as you all know, the Bretton Woods II system, Bretton Woods II system was introduced by a strongly influential paper by Dooley, Fokker, Landau, and Garber in 2003. The three characterized the current system as a kind of Bretton Woods II system with a fixed, de facto fixed exchange system, and with this difference between a capital account region and a capital region, in the sense that Asia would be tracing the same path covered by Europe and Japan after World War II, a path towards the center of the system, thus supporting the value of the dollar, in particular through exchange reserves accumulation. Now, one of the most interesting and prominent features of the current system is, as you know, this piling up of exchange reserves, in particular by emerging countries, that is, by surplus countries. This picture on the right is just to show the historical trend, which is clearly upwards, even if the picture goes until 2006, but the red line is the one of developing countries who, as you can see, are continuously accumulating exchange reserves, feeding up the problem of global imbalances. And these two tables are just before November and December of 2008, and the last statistics taken from the IMF data, April and May 2009. As you can see, reserves are continuously piled up by emerging countries, and particularly by China. So why do we focus on reserves? Well, because this is a theoretical bridge between Keynes' vision in just before World War I and the current international problems and our troubled times, which derive in a way from a change of ideas in Asia. We are still here using Keynes' words in Indian Currency and Finance, because of the fact that after the Asian crisis in 1997, and the way out of the Washington Consensus failures was clearly found, as for example argued by Feilstein and Roderick, by this strategy adopted by developing countries of self-protection or policy autonomy through increased liquidity, that is, through accumulating exchange reserves. As I said, this is a problem which feeds the general problem of global imbalances, which is characterized by the fact that there is this coexistence between a node paradox of capital, the fact that developing countries are financing developed countries, already developed countries. But a new feature is that foreign lending is here made of exchange reserve accumulation. The problem in the Bretton Woods II system is that this kind of reserve accumulation has developed a great amount of literature about the reasons why developing countries should, in effect, lose resources in order to accumulate exchange reserves. The reasons why are found, first of all, in precautionary motives, and this is particularly the case for Latin America, while mercantilistic strategies would be at the basis of reserve accumulation by Asian countries in particular, who would be playing a sort of hoarding game in order to improve their competitiveness, in particular in U.S. markets. Probably both reasons lie at the basis of this accumulation of reserves. Here are some hints by the literature on the problems raised by this accumulation: capital losses, as obvious, but also opportunity costs in terms of both of external borrowing and failure to reduce short-term debt liabilities as an alternative to accumulate reserves. And then moral hazard problems, the fact that problems of overheating in particular may raise following this strategy. So there is a sort of social cost, the literature says. The puzzle of reserves in the current international setting is that, certainly as Cruz and Waters have argued, this decision, the strategy was adopted as a way of reinforcing countries' economic performances in a context of the adoption of a neoliberal strategy of a rapid financial liberalization. So that the rationale, says Eisenman, is that accumulating exchange reserves clearly enhances the stability of the emerging configuration in an era of greater financial integration. And the benefit is also that in this period of crisis, countries who accumulated reserves have been able to avoid the depreciation. Now, the fact is that actually the Bretton Woods II system may be described as a system characterized by expansiveness with instability. As Greenwald, Stiglitz, Ocampo, and Davidson, these are three references which are continuously recalled in the paper. As they show, actually, our system is a clearly an unstable system, since there are chronic growing deficits on the part of reserve countries. It is an inequitable system because it reduces policy space available, in particular to deficit and emerging countries. And in fact, it produces a deflationary environment because of the fact that the U.S., the world locomotive, is compelled to act as the deficit, the system's deficit of last resort. So why this come back to Keynes and Indian currency finance? Well, because in 1914, Keynes really looks in a fresh and new way to Asia, not only to India. The literature on Indian, the secondary literature on Indian currency and finance, this is what we try to show in the paper, is quite focused on the book as if the book were a single country assessment, not dealing at all or just a little with purely international issues, and finally showing Keynes's imperialism. But what we try to do in the paper is to concentrate exactly on the opposite side of on this coin, that is, on the fact that Keynes looks at Asia more in general rather than at India alone. He tries to depict a new international system, saying that the proper object of a good currency must be to combine cheapness with stability. And in the paper we also defend the thesis that one way of rediscovering Keynes for our troubled times is to focus in particular on the method of Keynes's analysis. Following Anna's previous works, in particular, we focus on the idea that well, the method that Keynes used to cope with international economic relations was quite similar to the one he developed and followed in general when treating the economic material. So that we try to see Keynes as a thinker of complexity, even in international relations, thus following a sort of a previous attempt by David Bynes in a beautiful review of Skidelsky's biography of Keynes to focus exactly on the international vision of Keynes as a thinker of complexity. This is why we talk about the method. Well, this is part of a more general program we are trying to carry on, in which, for example, and for maybe the clearest example of this is shown by the fact that in a previous work we have tried, for example, to see in the economic consequences of the piece written by Keynes in the aftermath of World War I, an example of how to cope with a global interdependence in such a way as to avoid reducing the complexity characterizing international relationships. So that, for example, we saw the economic consequences of the piece as Keynes' attempt to look at the reparation issue as if it were, in effect, a problem of global interdependence with various economic and political variables which were organically interconnected, with European countries and Germany at the center of this European body, as Keynes says in the economic consequences of the peace, as entrapped in a sort of dilemmas as regards their economic and political future, so that an external assistance, as in complex system often happens, was required, American assistance and British assistance to Germany in particular, to find a solution to an otherwise unescapable European problem. Now, well, first of all, in the paper we try to demonstrate that Keynes' look is at Asia in general. He himself wrote a memorandum before Indian Currency and Finance, a memorandum on the currency system for China, saying that India had developed a beautiful gold exchange standard, but that India was not alone in this path, and that the gold exchange standard that Keynes was trying to defend in the book and in the general attempt to extend it to the whole international system in Europe was in effect the prevailing form of currency in Asia. Now, that was a scientific and economical system, he wrote. It is cheaper, this is the way he defined it, to maintain a credit at one of the great financial centers of the world, which can be converted with great readiness into gold when it is required, and which earns a small rate of interest when it is not required. So that, contrary to Bretton Woods' true system, that kind of system was to combine cheapness with stability. As you can see, he wrote against, the whole book was clearly against the attempt to introduce a pure gold standard in India. Despite the attempt by the government to introduce it, India had unintentionally, in a way, evolved a gold exchange standard. But this was a positive feature because the gold standard was not more than a relic of time, and the idea of introducing a pure gold standard in India was just due to the fashion to imitate uncritically the system which had been established in England, he wrote. Not only, but it is tacitly assumed that was a great problem with the introduction of a pure gold standard in India, that the greater part of what has to be withdrawn from the circulation at the time of crisis would come from the gold portion of circulation. But Keynes notes, at the time of crisis, it is exactly the fiduciary coins which the public are most eager to part with. So, first of all, complexity. This is the legacy and focus and method I talked about just a little, some minutes ago. Indian currency and finance is, as Keynes explicitly maintains, an essay in complexity. He closes the book by saying, every part of the Indian system fits into some other parts. It is impossible to say everything at once. And an author must needs sacrifice from time to time the complexity and interdependence affecting the interest of the clearness of its exposition, but at the same time the complexity and coherence of the system require a constant attention of anyone who criticizes its parts. This is not a peculiarity, he adds, of Indian finance, but it is the characteristic of all monetary problems. So in the paper we try to deal with this methodological assessment by Keynes of focusing on complexity. Interdependence is clearly a major issue of the book, although the secondary literature does not focus usually on this thing. As you can see, Keynes clearly distinguished, well, he actually depicts an international system, dividing countries according to their creditor or debtor situation, and even posing them on a sort of ideal line to analyze the features of the system. He says the position of a country which is preponderantly a creditor in the international short loan market is quite different from that of a country which is preponderantly a debtor. That is one of the most important reasons why he did not want to introduce the pure gold standard in India, because there were clearly special characteristics which differentiated countries in the context of this international system. He says a machinery which is adapted for action of the first kind may be ill-suited for the action of the second. So that, he continues, if the money market is not a lender in the international market, he says the bank itself must be at pains to become to some extent one. The interesting thing is that the alternative he found to this strategy would be the holding of a much larger reserve of gold, the expense of which would be nearly intolerable. That is why the new method, the gold exchange standard, combines safety with economy. Now, safety with economy, the fact is that Keynes in Indian currency and finance develops a line of thought which will be pursued throughout the whole of his career. The fact that we should struggle against this powerful, natural, and yet unfounded prejudice. The fact that gold reserves are meant to be used in times of difficulty and for the discharge of pressing obligations. But at the same time, wonderfully few other countries have yet learned, he wrote, that gold reserves, although they serve some purpose when they are held for show on, exist a much better purpose if they are held for use also. That is why in the paper we focus in particular on this kind of futuristic reversal of roles of Keynes pictures in the book. Well, as always with Keynes, or at least this is our opinion, when Keynes draws a sort of a futuristic scenario, yesterday Victoria Schick talked about economic possibilities for our own children. This is a clear example of this. When Keynes draws a futuristic scenario, this is not to change the future, but to change the present. And that is why we interpreted this passage from Keynes as exactly the idea of proposing a rational European monetary reform at the time when Keynes is writing. So he says, well, according to Gibbons, India's love of gold had saved Europe from inflation. But at the same time, the time may be not far distant when Europe, having perfected her mechanism of exchange on the basis of a gold standard, will find it possible to regulate her standard of value on a more rational and stable basis. And he adds, it is not likely that we shall leave permanently the most intimate adjustment of our economic organism at the mercy, for example, of a change of ideas in Asia. So, in the paper we focus in particular on the rationality of policy, the fact that Keynes clearly struggles for a rational European system and a rational reform of the monetary system, because he criticizes the unintentional evolution of the Indian system towards a gold exchange standard. This was a positive feature, but at the same time it was an unintended evolution. So that there is clearly a passage here in which Keynes's rationality is implied is used in the same terms that he would use in the Treatise on Probability when he focuses exactly on the problem of rationality of policy. The rational monetary reform is thus to be compared in negative with the unintended evolution of the India gold exchange standard, the gold reserve thought of as being some sort of charm, and the adjustment mechanism being at the mercy of a change of ideas in Asia. Now, to conclude, in the paper we stress in particular the continuity between inner currency and finance and the last reform plans by Keynes, saying that, first of all, it is his first critique of the model of commodity money, finally rejected in advance from Bretton Woods. It is also an international system, the one he wanted to build, able to establish sustainable relationships between debtors and creditors, and to increase policy space available to debtors and emerging countries and emerging nations. That is why also in the International Currency Union plan he refers to the gold standard, but I think it's much more this kind of gold standard as an example of a good kind of international adjustment, although the gold standard had other effects. To use it as a guide to rethink the Bretton Woods II system is to underline that the rational international monetary reform Keynes advocated was combining cheapness as against the cost produced by the global reserve system of today with stability, as opposed to the deflationary environment it produces. So it is also true that at the times of the crisis, emerging countries are starting to use international reserves, but at the same time, there is a fear of losing international reserves, which is clearly shown at an international level, and reserve accumulation is still the safest development strategy, as Dulé, Fogel, Landau, and Gaber argue, in the world of the crisis. After, above all, reserve accumulation leads to a fallacy of composition, which is exactly the problem of global imbalances. This is the last slide, just summing up what I've been saying. And this is clearly the proposals of a sort of Keynes-inspired Bretton Woods III, taking into consideration previous works by Greenwood, Stiglitz, Ocampo, Davidson, and generally post-Keynesian economists. The idea of decoupling reserve accumulation from the deficit position of reserve countries, coordinated international adjustment with most symmetrical rules, and a true global currency is a more rational and stable store of international trade. Thank you, and sorry for that.
You need to stall an extra minute. That's okay.